Okay, we're going to start with Perek Ches. Where we stand now, Gideon had just had his miraculous victory over the camp of Midian, which basically played out that Gideon came with an army of 300 men, and basically all he did was cause pandemonium, cause he upset the whole camp of Midian. They all just fell into turmoil. They started killing each other. They fled. And then basically what happened was Gideon rallied all kinds of other Shevatim from Klal Yisrael who joined the chase. And by this time he already did have a whole big army chasing them and killing them. As we saw last week, Hashem had boiled it down to a very small army because he wanted the victory to be very clear. But that was only for the actual battle. The subsequent chasing was okay if it would be done by a larger army as well. There's one point that we brought out last week that I just want to come back and clarify. I don't know if it was clear enough. We said last week, we discussed the difference between Gideon's battle and the Devorah's battle. Whereby the war with Devorah, Hashem set the amount of the army at 10,000. Whereas with Gideon, 10,000 was much too much. Hashem set it at 300. And we discussed last week what the difference was, and why Gideon had actually thought initially that 10,000 should be good. So the logic with Devorah was, as we saw, you get together an army of 10,000, you're likely to have a minion of good men. That was basically the logic. In fact, I heard that implemented in a practical way. Someone asked, it was in the Baal Tshuva Yeshiva, where the Rosh Yeshiva weren't sure how to deal with Talmidim who wanted to go daven in Uman on Rosh Hashanah. They weren't sure how to deal with it. It wasn't the thing in that Yeshiva. They weren't sure how to deal with it. So they asked Rav Aaron Leib Shteinman. So he said, "Yeah, I don't know exactly what's involved in Uman itself. I'll just say one thing. In a place where you have a minion of 5,000 people, it's a good place to daven because it's likely to be a minion of people davening with Kavanah." So in any case, it's a good place to daven. So why not? Okay. But whatever it is, we said that there was a difference. Yes, in Devorah's place, Hashem said, you can afford to do that. You can afford to take a big crowd, hoping to have that handful of righteous people that will be the core of that crowd. Whereas with Gideon, Hashem didn't want that. Hashem didn't want the surplus. Why didn't Hashem want the surplus? Because there was a difference between Gideon's generation and Devorah's generation. In the virus generation, even the people who weren't that core that could actually cause the salvation were on high enough a level to be able to appreciate where the salvation was coming from, why it happened, and the effect would not be ruined. Everybody would come back reporting the greatness of the miracle. Whereas in Gideon's time, if he would have gone with an army of 10,000, and the vast majority were not quite on the level, the surplus there would not have related to it right at all. They might have not attributed it right. They might have said, we were great warriors, we came with great techniques, etc. The point being that even the surplus has to be on the right level. Yeah, you can go with the understanding that you have the core of the army that's really meriting the victory, and the surplus won't harm, but that's only if the surplus is on the right level, not to ruin the effect. Not to ruin the effect by starting to attributing it to their own skill. But once they are, then the surplus are just detrimental to the cause. We want to get rid of it. And therefore we have to note, I really realized this afterwards when I did the math again, that in Gideon's time also, if you're going proportionally, there was definitely surplus among those 300 men also. Because he started off with an army of 32,000. They were left with 300 men, which is a lot more than the proportions we were talking about before. We were talking about maybe 1 of 1,000. 300 men is 1 in 100 out of 30,000, right? So, what's the pshat?
1 in 100 as opposed to
1 in 1,000.
Where by tomorrow?
Yeah, where the cheshbon was, you would have a minion of good people in the 10,000. So here also there was a surplus. Right? They had more than that 1 in 1,000, and a lot more than 1 in 1,000. 1 in 1,000 would have been 3 people. They had 97 surplus people. So the answer is yes, there was surplus here too. But even the surplus people had to be boiled down to the right people. Even the simplest people have to be boiled down to the right thing. Meaning, it's like Rabbeinu Yonah says, even if you're not quite on the level of the great Talmid HaChachamim, etc., the question is, do you associate yourself with them? You can do as the there's the core, and then there's the what surrounds the core is also okay, but you have to qualify for that. And then you can be considered in their category. Okay, now we'll move on. We begin Perek Ches. So after this whole victory, where what happened was Gidon from Shevet Menashe had his 300 people from the few Shvatim that he rallied. We basically saw it was Naphtali and Zvulun, right, who are the nations that he called. What people from Menashe and from Asher, Zvulun, and Naphtali? Those were the Shvatim that he took with him to battle. Okay. Then afterwards, when he already won, he sent to more Shvatim to come join him in the chase. Among those that he called to join him was Shevet Ephraim. So afterwards, Vayemru Elav Ish Ephraim. This coming parak is very interesting because it gives us a real flavor of the dynamics of those times. The people of Ephraim said to him, Ma hadomar azel tisalanu. How do you have the nerve to do this to us? They said to him. What? Levilti krois lanu. Ki alachta lilachim b'midyan. That you didn't call us when you went off to fight Midian. Vayiribun itay b'chazka. And they quarreled with him very strongly. I mean, he was turning into a very, very serious fight. They were really upset. So let's just understand. This parak is very insightful. What the dynamics here were. So I want to put this mamash into the perspective of the whole period of the Shevet. First of all, let's just ask a general question. Why did the whole thing have to play out this way? Where was the army? Was there no organized army? The answer is no, there wasn't an organized army. We're talking in the days of the Shevetim. The days of the Shevetim, there was no organized government among the Jewish people. And there was no organized army either. As we've already seen, when a war came up, somebody took the initiative and rallied people together and they went out to fight, trained, not trained, whatever it is, there was no organized army. Right? These were the days of the Shevetim when the Jewish people were basically a self-governing bunch. There was no king, there was no operating government, there were courts that dealt with things as they came up. But there was no operating government, and therefore it was a situation of, like the Pasuk says, Ish hayosho be'inov yaseh. Each man did what was right in his own eyes, which, as we've mentioned in the past, is often understood in a negative way. But the truth is that it's meant very literally. The Jewish people at that time lived by the dictates of their conscience. They managed to live without rule for hundreds of years. And you see that the spirit of Klal Yisrael was such that yes, when there was a need to rally together for war, people rallied together for war. But lamaisa, there were dynamics. There were dynamics, as we're going to see soon. In general, this was a good system, but it was a precarious system. Meaning, there will definitely, when you have a situation like this where an entire nation is running without a government, there will definitely be those who are not going to live up to the standards. You're definitely going to have areas or pockets where people are not going to be exactly what they need to be. When it spread a little too much, the time came to appoint a king. But in general, this was something that worked for many years, for about 400 years. Okay, so let me keep to this side just to get so. But lamaisa, there were dynamics. One of the dynamics was that there was Shevet Ephraim. Besides the fact that we see at different points that there was a certain tension between Shevet Ephraim and Shevet Menashe, which Gideon was from, in general, Shevet Ephraim was considered a very prestigious Shevet, a very chashuv Shevet. That's why even later in history, it was already from earlier in history, right, who was the first leader after Moshe Rabbeinu? It's Yeshua ben Nun from Shevet Ephraim. And we saw Yaakov Avinu giving special focus to Shevet Ephraim. And also later, right, when the kingdom did split, who was the king in the tribes of Yisrael, Shevet Ephraim. And always in the Pesukim later you see that there was rivalry between Shevet Ephraim and Shevet Yehuda. Shevet Ephraim was a very strong and proud Shevet, and they were considered one of the more important Shvatim. And therefore what actually happened here was Menashe was considered inferior to Ephraim. And the people of Ephraim did not appreciate the fact that someone from Shevet Menashe went along and laid claim to the glory, led the battle. That's supposed to be us. Who do you think you are? And we're not dealing here with the higher level people of Shevet Ephraim. We'll see soon. We're not dealing here with the higher level people of Shevet Ephraim. We're talking about the people that simply the tribal pride manifested in not the greatest way. And they simply couldn't handle the fact, they couldn't swallow the fact that Menashe, right? They come along and they're claiming the fame. They're claiming the glory. They're becoming the heroes. What a chutzpah. Who do you think you are?
Isn't liberation better than the ego in this particular point?
But they wanted both. They said, why didn't you call us? We should be the ones heading the battle.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, where were they for all these years?
That's a good question. That's right. That's a good question. And the truth is that there's an even better answer. Because Gideon, again, let's remember, Gideon didn't, he wasn't free to select whoever he wanted to go. He did rally certain Shvatim, and the truth is that was their point. It's true. Hashem, at the end of the day, didn't just let anybody join the army, right? Hashem boiled it down very much. So Gideon could have told them, Rabbeisa, you saved yourself embarrassment by not being called to the army. You would have been sent home in disgrace. Right? But still, they could say, look, you rallied other Shvatim, why didn't you rally us? Why didn't he? Perhaps he was worried that if he would have rallied them, they would say, who do you think you are calling us to battle? Right? If we're not going, you think you could go? So he did go. And then they come and say, hey, what do you think you're doing? Whatever it is, we're talking about people whose ego was stepped on and they couldn't handle it. And therefore they came to him with kindness. Who do you think you are? You didn't do it right anyways, right? We're the ones who know how to do it. So what does Gideon answer? Vayomer aleihem. So he answered them, Mel sisi ato kochem. He says, what are you worried about that I came and stole the show? All I did was set things up for you to come and claim the glory. Have I done what you've done? He says, at the end of the day, who won this battle? He hands it to them, right? He says, what did I do? I came, I blew some shofars, I got things running. You came and you killed them, right? You killed the two kings. It's all you. I didn't do anything. He says, the grapes at the end of the season, usually at the end of the season you already have the inferior grapes, are better than the initial harvest of Aviezer, that was his family, Aviezer Menashe. Meaning, yeah, I started the war, and you finished the war, but look, you achieved the victory. You killed the two kings. This is all you. Biedchem nosan Elohim es sarei Midian. Hashem gave the officers of Midian into your hands. Es oire ve'ezeh. That was their names. Could I have done what you did? Oh, listen how he's mamish buttering them up. They heard all that. Ah, their ego, their pride was restored. Az rapsa rucha me'alav. Then their temper against him was calmed. Bedabroi hadavar hazeh. When he spoke this way. So now, Gideon's humility, we're really saying this is also characteristic with what we've seen him earlier. Lowers his head, fine, you want the credit, it's all you, I didn't do a thing. Who would even think that I could do what you did? I just set things up for you, I was the scout. Nothing, it's all you. Fine. And they're happy, they go home happy. Okay.
When we say Ephraim came out to, what does that mean? Does that mean the whole people came up, or
they're... That's Ish Ephraim, people of Ephraim. Presumably it means the ones who were participating in the war.
What you mentioned before, that they weren't the higher level people.
What's that? The higher level people wouldn't have come at this time. And as we'll see soon also, they weren't, the truth is that they weren't quite, kind of like you pointed out before, who were they up till now? We're going to see soon. The question can also be asked, where were they after this? We'll see. So, you know, these were people who, their pride was hurt. Now, now the truth is that the war wasn't finished yet. There was still a large part of the Midianites not such a large part. We'll see soon. It was 15,000 out of 135,000 were still left. And they ran away. They did manage to get away, right? They were the survivors. Most of the people were wiped out by Ephraim and by the other Shvatim, but they were the survivors who did manage to get across the Yarden, together with two more. They were all together four officers of Midian. It was Erev and Ze'ev. They had already been killed. But there were another two captains, or kind of like minor kings, whatever they were, Zebach and Salmuna. And they led the remaining 15,000 survivors across the Jordan. And what happened was, they were very upset, obviously. Can't blame them. And when they got across the Jordan, they started terrorizing the Jews on the other side of the Jordan. They didn't even calm down. They didn't even catch their breaths. They came and just started destroying on the other side of the Jordan. So Gideon continued the chase. Vayoba Gideon Hayardeno. So Gideon came to the Yarden, ready to pass. Who does he have with him? Oh, what happened to Ephraim, who complained before that they hadn't been called out for the war? They were back home eating supper. And who's at the end of the day continuing the chase now? Gideon and his original 300 men. That's all. Those are the only ones continuing now. They were already weary, exhausted and hungry. They'd already been here for a while. But they continued pursuing. They kept up the chase. They were talking about the real people, right? The real men. These were the ones who Hashem named as the ones who were worthy to go out to battle. They continued the chase even though they were so weary, and even though the others who had come to help now just went back home. Now, we come on to an interesting point. Vayomer la'anshei Sukkos, as he is ready to cross the Yarden in pursuit of the remaining survivors with his 300 men, his weary 300 men, he hit a place called Sukkos, Jewish area. So he said, "Tnu lanu, tnu na kiknois lechem."
Yeah. The Jewish area on the other side.
What's that? So I don't know if this was still on the first, before he actually passed, like as he was ready to pass, or if it was actually after he passed, but they were around the Yarden, on one side or the other. So he comes and he says to the people of Sukkos, "Tnu na kiknois lechem la'om asher beragli. Please give some bread to the people who are with me. Ki ayefim him, because they're weary, they're hungry. And I am busy chasing after Zevach and Salmuna, the kings of Midian." So he's making two claims. He says, first of all, you have a bunch of hungry and tired Jews. That's already enough of a reason. But besides that, I'm here on behalf of the whole Jewish people. You should be a part of this anyways. Provide us with some food. Vayayna sarei Sukkos. And the officers of Sukkos responded. Now listen to this. Sorry?
Didn't Ephraim already dispatch them?
Who?
The two kings?
No, he said there were four kings altogether. They killed Erev and Ze'ev. There was another two. Apparently these were like minor dukes or whatever they are. Sometimes they're called officers, sometimes they're called kings. But there were four of them. There were two left with their surviving soldiers. So, Vayomer sarei Sukkos. So the officers of Sukkos responded to his justified request.
These are Jews or
non-Jews? Jews. They offered him, they responded to him and they said, "Hakat zeva v'tzalmuna atobi yodecha? Are the hands of Zevach and Salmuna in your hand?" Meaning, have you actually captured them already? "Kinitem litzvach olecha? You're on your way out to fight. Who said you're going to win? You're coming and asking us for food? Have you done anything yet?" He's already won, well, more than half the battle. He's already won about 90% of the battle. But, no, you haven't finished the job. Don't come and ask us for anything. First, let's see you do the job. Now, the truth is that it's not as mean as I just made it sound. They said, "One minute, do you have Zevach and Salmuna in your custody? These were the people who had been terrorizing the Jews up till now. Do you have them in your custody? If you don't have them in your custody, we're a little scared to give you food. Because as far as we're concerned, you're 300 people going to threaten the persecutors. If you're going to lose, they're going to come back to us with kindness. And they're going to come back and they're going to get even with us. So we're scared to give you the food." But it was somewhere in between. Because the truth is, basically what they were saying was, come on, you're going to take them on. I don't know what they do about the fact they saw that up till now Gideon had won the first 120,000, but they said, look, you're going with your measly 300 men, and look at them, these are soldiers, these, you know, straggly beards, these are, we already saw, these were not necessarily the qualified soldiers. These were the people who made it through the selection process in terms of spirituality. So they kind of looked at Gideon and they said it was a mixture of a good excuse, but also a certain put down. They said, it's all very nice and you're very idealistic and I'm sure you have a lot of emuna, and we certainly respect that, but come on, you're going with these 300 people. You got lucky the first time, right? You scared the camp, and then you're lucky you had these other shvatim come and help you out. But now, what are you, nuts? The 300 of you are continuing? We're not giving you anything. We can't be a part of this. We can't support this. Vayomer Gideon, and Gideon responded, Lochein, if so, he swore, B'seis Hashem es zevach v'tzalmuna v'yodi, when Hashem does deliver zevach and tzalmuna into my hands, v'dashti es b'sarchem, es koitze amidbo v'sabarkonim, I will thresh your flesh with the thorn bushes of the desert and with the bramble.
Is this
going? No. If you have thorn brushes pressed all over your body, you're going to come away scratched and scarred, and you're not going to be comfortable for a long time, but you'll survive. It's okay.
There's a key,
it's healthy.
Because even as a judge, yeah, which was, I guess, like a king, doesn't he have something called domain where he just sees the bread for himself and the soldiers?
Oh, so apparently he wasn't in position to do so necessarily. I don't know if he simply wasn't able of taking them on at that point. I don't know. Why didn't he seize it? But whatever it is, you hit onto the right point. What he was actually saying now was, yes, he was coming with the authority of a shefet. Up till now, Gideon was acting humble. But now he was exercising the full authority of a shefet. As a shefet, the Abba Banal says, he had the status of the king in this sense. He was able to decide to punish people simply because they weren't cooperating with his orders. And therefore he said, when I get back, I'm going to give you the thorn treatment. Meaning I'm going to thresh thorn bushes on you. Not going to kill them, but he's going to put them through a very unpleasant experience.
Where do we know that punishment anywhere in the
Torah? No, this is the king or Shefet's authority to punish as he sees fit.
How many people are in Sukkot that are being defined?
So here he's just talking to the officers, as we'll see.
Like a dozen?
I don't know what the numbers were. Now, Vayal Misham Penuel. So from there, the next stop was Penuel. He tried his luck there also. Maybe the people of Penuel will give bread. And he spoke to them the same as he spoke to the people of Sukkos. And the people of Penuel answered him the same way the people of Sukkos answered him. So he said, Gamla Anche Penuel. He said also to the people of Penuel. He said, Leimor. He said, Beshuvi Bisholim. When I return in peace, Etoitz es hamigdol hazeh, I will smash this fortress. Meaning, the people of Pua was a different story than Sukkot. The people of Pua lived in a fortress. It was a big fortress. Therefore, they felt secure. It was different than the refusal of the people of Sukkot. They were refusing because they said, we don't need your whole campaign. We're fine. We're secure. You can't threaten us. And neither can the people of Midian. We're fine. We're secure. This is a manifestation of what we were saying before. Yes, this was the time of the Shoftim, but it wasn't the central government. And here is an example of a place that deteriorated. These people reached a situation where they decided they lost any sense of national responsibility, out of care on the national level. They said, we're going to make sure we're fine. Everybody else can jump in the lake.
Was that different than the first reaction of the first Sukkot?
The people of Sukkot were apprehensive. Yes, they were shirking their... They weren't ready to take up the initiative. But it wasn't the difference. They were saying, we don't have faith in you. And we're scared that they're going to come back to take revenge. Right? That's what they were saying. And therefore, we don't want to give you food. Okay? Now, we'll discuss soon. They certainly had to be taken to task. But yet, what they did was not the most terrible thing in the world. These people, however, it was a whole different story. These people were saying, this whole thing is not relevant to us. It's got nothing to do with us. right? And therefore, he spoke stronger than he did to them. Again, the thorn brushes was not going to be a pleasant experience. But it's something you get over after 3 weeks, 4 weeks, right? There will be some scars left, but survive. Basically, life will continue as it was. But here he says, I'm going to destroy. I'm going to destroy your fortifications. It's a whole different story. We'll see soon that it actually came to more than that. He ended up wiping out this place entirely. But we'll leave that for when we get there. Because once again, this was already a whole different story. These were people who were saying that we don't care. The plight of the Jewish people is not our plight. We just make sure we're secure, and that's all. What's that?
More than not, then.
It was flaunting the authority of the shofar.
What did they touch me? I've never seen that word. What does that mean?
What's that?
What was that word that meant? What was it?
I'll smash. Entoits will entoit. It means to smash. So here we have to note something. Let's just note the contrast, Gideon's personality, right? With the first, Ephraim came and challenged him. Right? Ephraim came and challenged him, and they said, how can you do this? And they were ready to make a whole fight against him. How did he respond? He lowered his head, and he said, you know what, I'm nothing, you're everything, it was all you. All of a sudden here, when he's being defied, how does he react? Steel, right? Tough as nails. What's the difference? The difference is that before it was a personal thing. These people were ready to do what was needed to be done. These people were ready to respond to his call. On the contrary, they felt that they should be the ones doing it, right? Which they took offense at the fact that he didn't call. It was a personal tie that they were doing, right? And, okay, you have something personal against me. It's on a personal level. I'm going to lower myself. I'm going to lower my head, let it pass. I don't have to stick up for my ego. If it's my ego that's at stake here, if that's the issue, forget it, you can trample my ego. I don't care about my ego. That was Gideon's humility. But here it's already a different story. Here it's an issue of people. Here it's an issue of Klal Yisrael. Here it's an issue of principle. As far as Klal Yisrael is concerned, these are people who are denying their responsibility towards Klal Yisrael. That's something that has to be dealt with in the most severe way. Here, he wasn't going to let go at all. This is from his sense of national responsibility. There's so much conflicted with what he was all about. We saw earlier that he was chosen for this job because of his care of Klal Yisrael. And his job was to be taking care of Klal Yisrael. To come across people who could just come and say, we're fine, we're only worried about ourselves. The rest of Klal Yisrael can jump in the lake. That he responded to in the most severe way. Now, V'zerach v'tzalmuna b'karkar. Zevach and Salmuna were in Karkar, okay? There's an area there in the Transjordan. Umachanei and Imam, they had their camp with them, Chameshes Osar Elef, about 15,000 men. Kol HaNoisorim Mikol Machanei Bnei Kedem. These were the survivors of the original camp of these people of the East. Those who had fallen were 120,000 men, 120,000 warriors, people, swordsmen. So here we see what actually happened in this story. Gideon had killed, or Gideon's campaign had killed 120,000. There were 15,000 left. So here also, I just want to back up and note for a minute. Let's go back to the people of Sukkos. They said, "Well, we're not confident that you can actually do it." How's that? With his 300 men, he wiped out 120,000. There's another 15,000 left. What are they not confident about? What are they worried about?
Home field advantage.
What's that?
Home field advantage. Meaning the people on the Transjordan side, they knew the terrain and they knew how to play using the terrain.
That's possible. But yet, if you see that 300 people wiped out 120,000, there's obviously a higher forces working here than just the question of home field advantage. Because 120,000 should be able to beat the 300 on foreign territory too. Right? So, obviously what was going on here is, and this is something that's relevant all the time, it's all a question of perspective. From the people of Penuel's perspective and of Sukkos, that's not what they saw. They saw something a little more natural. It's like I described before. This is what I was getting at before. If 300 religious fanatics came, they got a lucky break. What did they do? They didn't do the fighting, like we said before. Gideon and his men didn't do any fighting. What did they do? They blew shofars outside the camp. They got the whole camp running. Who actually did the fighting? The Shvatim, the other Shvatim that came pouring down the mountains. Right? He had Zvulun and Naphtali and Asher and Ephraim joined, right? He called people from all over the place and they came and did the fighting. So the people of Sukkos, they were already, they were not spiritually attuned. What they saw was, everything we saw in the natural perspective, what they saw was, these people, it's incidental, right? They got the ball rolling. Lemaisa, it was the other Shvatim that did the fighting. And therefore you have these hotheads who are continuing. That the guy, he doesn't realize that he got away, he came off lucky the first time. He's naive enough to think, right? The real warriors of Ephraim, they went back home. They understand that, okay, we got lucky here. Now on the other side, they, like you said, they have home field advantage. They went back home. The ones who understood battle weren't continuing the fight at this point. You have those hotheads, those fanatics who started the whole business. They're going to continue to the other side of the Jordan to chase the 15,000.
300 men. So what does that mean for people coming down the hill?
No, again, he started with his 300 men. Once pandemonium broke loose in the Midian camp, other Shvatim joined. Like we said earlier, Hashem was particular that no more than 300 should attack. But afterwards, anybody who wants to join in the chasing was welcome to do so. And Gideon, in fact, rallied members of other Shvatim to join the chasing. So yes, Gideon and his 300 men, what they did was, they blew their shofars, they got the Midian camp running, and then you had thousands of members of other Shvatim chasing them and killing them. So at the end of the day, from the superficial perspective, you could say, yes, this battle was fought by Ephraim and these other Shvatim. All Gideon did was, he got a lucky break. He scared the people of Midian and got them running. He couldn't have taken them on. And therefore, it's the people of Sukkot who are telling him now also. There's nothing miraculous here. Don't talk religious. Right? You people are nuts. The warriors went back home. It's you 300 guys who got things moving in the first place. Fine, very nice. You did that. Good job. You deserve a pat on the back. You're going now to fight further. They saw this from a natural perspective. This is what they saw.
So,
he's saying that might have also helped enhance the effect of what they were scared of, right? So now, whatever it is, Zevach and Zalmunna are in Karkar with their 15,000 men. Okay? Now, Vaya'al Gideon derech hashchune ba'ahalim. Gideon passed by, he came with his men, and he passed by this area of, there was a whole area of like nomads living there. He passed that whole area, Mikidam leNoivach veYogba, which was east of Noivach and Yogba. These are areas in the Transjordan. Vayaches haMachane, and then he attacked the camp of Midian. VeHaMachane hoya betach. Here also we see that again, those who are just doing it from the material perspective did not see the miracle in what happened. The camp of Zevach and Zalmunna, after they passed the Transjordan and they set up shop on the other side of the Jordan, they weren't scared anymore. They were sitting securely. They didn't dream that Gideon would chase them to the other side of the Jordan. Apparently they too understood that from the perspective of natural battle, it wouldn't make sense to chase them. That's why the other warriors didn't. And therefore, when Gideon came at them across the Jordan, they were completely unprepared. They were sitting securely, peacefully. And once again, he caused the whole camp to panic. Vayanusu Zevach v'Zalmunna. Zevach v'Zalmunna fled. Vayudoif acharein. And he pursued them. Vayokoy v'shnei malchei Midian. And he captured the two kings of Midian as Zevach v'Zalmunna. Zevach and Zalmunna. V'kol hamachane hichrid. And all the rest of the camp, he simply, once again, upset. Basically, apparently followed the same style. He didn't even necessarily kill them. It was similar to what happened before. He suddenly came upon them again. Just pandemonium broke loose again. Gideon and his men were able to simply come and pluck the kings out of the whole balagan and leave. Vayoshev Gideon ben Yoyosh min ha-milchama mil male echores. And Gideon ben Yoash came back from the war with his prisoners while the sun was still shining. Meaning, this whole second part of the story didn't take more than a day. Right? The first part of the story was at night, that first attack. And by the time he chased them across the Transjordan, upset them again, and came back with the captive kings, the day had not even passed. And now he's coming back to settle some accounts. Right? Now he's coming back victorious with these two kings in his hand. Vayilkod na'ar me'anshei Sukkos, and he caught a child from the people of Sukkos. Now again, the Sukkos, he had an account to settle just with the officers of the city. So he captured this child. Vayichtav elav esori Sukkos vezkeneo shivim v'shiva ish. And he demanded from that child to tell him, to make him a list. The child made for him a list of the elders and officers of Sukkos, 77 men. These were the people responsible for the original decision to refuse Gideon's request. Vayavoy el anshei Sukkos. And he came to the people of Sukkos, vayomer, and he said, Hine zevach v'tzalmuna asher chiraftem oisileimar. Oh, remember you asked me about Zevach and Salmuna? Here they are. Meet Zevach and Salmuna. These are the people that you ridiculed me before, Lamar, saying, Hakap Zevach with Salmuna Tobi Adecha. Back then you looked at me condescendingly and you said, well, do you have Zevach and Salmuna? Kini ten lana shecha hayeifin lechem, which would warrant us giving to your hungry men bread. They said, now here they are. Vayikach ez zikneo ir, and he took the elders of the city, ves koitzei hamidbar, ves habarkanim, and he took the thorn brush and the bramble, vayoida bohem es anshei Sukkos, and he broke them on the people of Sukkos. Okay, what about Penuel? Ves migdal Penuel notatz, and indeed, the fortress of Penuel, he smashed, he destroyed it, vayaharoig es anshei ha'ir, and he killed the people of the city. Here it's questionable among the Mefarshim. Why did he do that? And was that what he was planning on doing originally? Some of the Mefarshim say that that's what he was actually alluding at. When he told him in the first place, I'm going to smash you, I'm going to destroy your fortress, he meant I'll wipe out the whole city. Because, as opposed to the people of Sukkos, where it was just the elders who convened and handed down the decision, in the case of the people of Penuel, it was the whole town. That's what you see in the Pasuk earlier. It doesn't say anything about officers. It was the whole town. But others say...
Just the men...
What's that?
Just the men?
I don't know. But other Mefarshim say that no, he...
Anshei Ha'ir, does that mean children and women as well?
It could. Anshei Ha'ir means the people of the city. I don't know. But other Mefarshim say that no, he never was planning on wiping out the whole city. He was planning on destroying the fortress like he said he would. But then they resisted. They fought him. And since they fought him, he fought them, and they ended up killing them. Whatever it is, once again, the point here is the same, however you slice it. These people had detached themselves from that sense of responsibility for the rest of Klal Yisrael. They didn't consider the rest of Klal Yisrael problems their own problem. So really, if we'll go with this latter approach of the Mefarshim, his plan was simply to destroy their fortress and make them feel alone with Klal Yisrael, Klal Yisrael is feeling, that's all. Don't be on your own planet. Now, with regard to the first bunch, the people of Sukkos. So here also we have to ask, was this really necessary? Okay, so they didn't believe. Was it really necessary? Especially since at the end of the day we saw that their refusal was kind of justified. They were afraid. But nevertheless, Gideon was coming in saying that it's an issue of national responsibility. Sometimes you have to put your fear to the side. Yes, we were ready to stick out our necks and actually go fight them. You, for the sake of Klal Yisrael, should at least be willing to stick out your necks and provide bread for us. The fact that you are afraid isn't necessarily an excuse. When you see that l'maisa, there's a chance to contribute to the salvation of Hashem's people, you stick your neck out. This is basic logic, right? Fear is a factor in any army. That's why desertion is punishable with death. It's because it's so scary and so justifiable that they have to punish it with death. Otherwise you won't have an army. So Gideon is saying, yes, the whole nation has to carry a sense of national responsibility.
Isn't there, don't soldiers who are afraid, aren't they allowed to leave the battlefield?
Well, that's in the Jewish army. No, I'm just using that as an example. When you are called upon to do something, you have to do it despite the fear. Fear there is a different story. There's more depth to it. But in this case, whatever it is, they were being called upon to at least provide the bread. I don't want to get into it right now. We'll still have opportunity to discuss that. But here they're being called upon to provide the bread. And they want to say, no, we want to keep our noses clean. That was unforgivable. Okay, I'll just make one point in parentheses. Sure, but I think another point is this out. They captured a child and had him write for them a list of the people of Sukkot. Here's something another time where you see kind of nuance that can be completely missed that has unbelievable significance. In those times, it was only the most educated, the most elite that wrote, that were literate. In Klal Yisrael, children were literate all throughout history, from the earliest of times. It was an unbelievable phenomenon. A phenomenon that existed only in Eretz Yisrael. Everywhere else in the world, most of the people, the common folk, couldn't write at all. Right. You had people, in fact, Rav Hirsch says that the Chartumim of Mitzrayim, right, one of their big distinctions was that they wrote. They wrote. They were the people who wrote in Mitzrayim. Literacy was widespread. Every last kid knew how to write in Gaza. This was a phenomenon that was completely non-existent until a couple of thousand years later in the rest of the world. And this also is meant to close the mouths of those who would like to portray the period of the Shoftim as a period of simple anarchy. That's why the points that we've been making throughout this year per se bring out how that was very much not the case. Simple anarchy, kind of like, you know, until they manage to get their act together. Look at this. Obviously a very, very high level of discipline, and a high level of motivation, a high level of conscientiousness, if the reality was that in this period of anarchy, you had little children knowing how to write, where it took the rest of the, all of the world, another couple of thousand years to get anywhere near this. Okay. Stop.